This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirts you wear. And I'm floating in a most peculiar way. And the stars look very different today.
Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 14 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. Tell us about today's topic.
Steve, we're getting away from the sometimes confounding aspects of astronomy and astrophysics this week with our topic, which is fire in space. And I can't imagine there are too many people who have not had some kind of experience with the frightening consequences of fire here on the ground. And in the past few years, the forest fires that we've seen all around the world, and certainly in BC, well, they've left their scars on our landscape. However, before we get into the details of this topic in space, as is our custom, I believe you have a couple of updates for us, Steve.
Well, I do, Tim. And in the spirit of last week's episode, I wanted to mention that 2024 continued to break records for space flights, with over 260 orbital flights in that year. 158 were from the US, 68 from China, and then a handful from other groups, including Europe, Russia, and Japan. Now, of these 260 orbital flights, only 6 were complete failures and 3 were partial failures. And that's pretty impressive when compared to the early days of space flights. Now, my other topic features a Canadian achievement which we always look for and proudly announce. And it's with regard to Canada's largest radio astronomy observatory, namely the Dominion Radio Astrophysical Observatory at White Lake, just outside of Penticton, BC.
Of course, you're referring to the Canadian Hydrogen Intensity Mapping Experiment, better known as CHIME, that we've previously mentioned here on Space Talks.
Quite so, and I've just become aware of the January 1st issue of a scientific journal called Nature, in which CHIME's team presents an article entitled, now hold on to your hats, Magnetospheric Origin of a Fast Radial Burst Constrained Using Scintillation.
Okay, Steve, listeners may recall that FRBs are millisecond-long bright flashes of radio waves from space. But come on now, fess up. I know very well you didn't understand the 17-page article, and you had to find the dumbed-down version, didn't you? So what's this all mean?
Come down. Yes, that would be me. Well, 4 new studies based upon CHIME's FRB observations are providing answers about where and how fast radio bursts originate. One recently observed FRB appears to have come from the chaotic, magnetically active environment near a type of dense neutron star called a magnetar, while another FRB appears to emanate from the outskirts of a distant, dead, star-starved galaxy.
That's a bit of a trailer here, Steve. Magnetars are one of the so-called exotic stars that we're going to explore in a future episode. And the name alone sounds almost exciting as blazers, and that's going to be quite the show.
It is, Tim. Now, CHIME's observations regarding the disparate origins of the signals suggest that FRBs may come in different flavors and originate in various ways. Lead author of all 4 studies, Dr. Ryan McKinven, working in the physics department at McGill University, says, quote, "This is a step closer to unraveling a profound cosmic mystery. FRBs are ubiquitous, yet their true nature remains largely unknown." And McKinven furthers that in an attempt to explain how FRBs are formed, scientists have 2 competing theories. One, where the signals form within a neutron star's magnetic environment, and another where it happens much farther out, driven by a shock launched from the star.
Okay, well, that's all fine and dandy, but what's this bit about magnetospheres and scintillation mentioned in the article's title?
I confess to having to dig deep on this one, Tim. Now, it turns out that the term magnetosphere refers to the magnetically active area about 10,000 kilometers away from a rotating neutron star. and scintillation refers to the glimmering effect created when the light from a small, bright object, such as a star or FRB, filters through a galaxy's interstellar medium or gas. The smaller or more distant an object, the more it twinkles.
Not what I would have guessed. I was thinking more about Danny Gallivan. You remember that? He's voice of the Montreal Canadiens way back in the 50s. In fact, he retired in 1984. He was the originator of scintillation term, as in plant makes a scintillating save. All that aside, hooray for Canada, Steve, Canadian scientist and the DRAO. Now, I've got a short update. Last week, we were talking about missions to Mars, and we made mention of the successful MAVEN expedition from India. That was famous in part for the low cost of putting a satellite into orbit around Mars. They did that for under $100 million. And so that was just a small example of India's determination to become a player in terms of space travel and exploration. Just a few weeks ago, India announced they had completed another first, their first capsule for human flight. The crew module is now being transported to a space center in Kerala, where it will be fitted with other communications, navigation, and power management. The Indian Space Research Agency has pushed back the date of that first crewed flight to no earlier than 2026. But they do plan a number of flights before that time to check out systems. And I have to mention this, Steve. On one or more of these flights, there will be a robot on board, a humanoid robot named Viomitra. I'm not sure if you can be complimentary about a humanoid robot's looks, but I have to say, she's darn good looking.
Well, thanks for that, Tim. And I understand that Viomitra translates into English as space friend. So at least there's one country with no fears about AI. And now, on to today's topic about fire and space. What have you got for us, Tim?
Well, certainly. There have been fires involving spacecraft on the ground and during reentry. And we're going to talk about those in a few minutes. But the good news, I suppose, is that no astronauts have actually lost battles with fires on board spacecraft while in orbit. But the risks of such fires are so great, and the science behind fire in space is really quite surprising.
And in that vein, Apollo 1 is probably the most famous spacecraft to have endured a fatal fire incident. And all three astronauts, Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee, died in that fire on January 17, 1967. One important factor we should mention right away is that the Apollo 1's capsule was filled with 100% oxygen, which greatly promoted the spread of fire. Subsequent Apollo missions had their atmosphere ratios of about 75% oxygen and 25% nitrogen.
But that's still a danger, isn't it, Steve? Because, you know, here on Earth, in our atmosphere, there's only 21% oxygen and 78% nitrogen.
And listeners to our show have likely heard us talk about that tragedy a couple of times, but it obviously has particular relevance today. And as you said, though, Tim, this was not a fire that took place in space. It happened on the ground during a training mission.
That's right. I think it's been fairly well documented that that pure oxygen environment that they had on board, even when it sat on the ground, was a central problem that amplified the risks of the tragic fire. There were also a number of other things going on, one of which was the capsule door, which opened inward. And given the dynamics of a fire, increasing pressure inside the capsule, that made pushing the door or pulling the door inward virtually impossible. However, one key part of all this was, in fact, human error. The prime contractor was called North American Aviation, and they were clearly responsible for poor workmanship and some lax safety standards. Another astronaut said of North American Aviation, quote, a slick, big-time bunch of Washington operators. And poor workmanship, well, that's been the cause of many fires, and not just in space, but in aircraft.
And speaking of that, Tim, I'm reminded of the June 2nd, 1983 Air Canada fire on board a DC-9, which took the life of Canadian folk singer Stan Rogers. That fire started in the rear lavatory, forcing the plane to land at Cincinnati Northern Kentucky International Airport. 90 seconds after the plane landed and the doors were opened, the heat of the fire and fresh air from the open exit doors created a flashover, and the plane's interior immediately became engulfed in flames, killing 23 passengers, half of all on board.
That accident became a watershed for global aviation regulations, which were changed in the aftermath to make aircraft safer. New requirements to install smoke detectors in laboratories, strip lights marking paths to exit doors, and increased firefighting training and equipment for crew became standard across the industry, while regulations regarding evacuation, well, they were updated. Since the accident, it has become mandatory for aircraft manufacturers to prove their aircraft could be evacuated within 90 seconds of the commencement of an evacuation. And passengers seated in overwing exits, of course, now instructed to insist in an emergency. Now, further, fire-blocking seat materials were made mandatory to limit both the spread of fire and the generation of toxic chemicals through ignition.
And before we leave the Apollo 1 fire, I'd like to just add a word or two about Gus Grissom. And what an incredible story in life that man led. He was one of the original Mercury astronauts, probably most famous for nearly drowning when bolts unexpectedly exploded on the capsule door when his spacecraft hit the Atlantic Ocean. But a few years prior to his astronaut career, he'd been flying combat missions in the Korean War and flew 100 missions in a six-month period. After his first suborbital Mercury flight, he would then command the first manned Gemini flight in March of 1965. He was assigned to the Apollo 1 mission, which was to have flown in February of 1967, and though it's not certain, it was certainly possible that Grissom might have commanded that mission, the first Apollo mission.
You don't think about that, Steve. Grissom was the second American to fly in the Mercury program after Alan Shepard, the first to fly in the Gemini program, and quite possibly, as you've said, could have been the first to fly on the Apollo flight. That is indeed quite a story.
Well, that's true. And there's a movie of that life. But for now, let's return to the subject of fire in space and why it's so different from what we think about fire here on the Earth.
Right. Well, the starting point is how fire works here on Earth and how gravity plays the biggest role. When something burns, hot air rises because it is less dense than the cooler air around the fire. The rising hot air creates something of a vacuum, and that results in nearby air and oxygen being drawn into the fire from below, keeping the fire going. However, in microgravity, what you have in low Earth orbit, there is no up or down because gravity is so weak. There is not hot air rising, in effect. So instead, the flames from the fire form a sphere. The heat spreads evenly in every direction, and that is the effect you see in movie representations of a fire that looks somewhat round and almost gentle in appearance. Now, back to the fuel, oxygen. It is not being drawn into the fire as happens on Earth. In space, it takes place in a much more random manner and more slowly. As a result, the fire burns cooler and dimmer as the oxygen isn't rushing into the fire as quickly. I think one of the key points here is that the fire in space behaves in far more unpredictable fashion. Without gravity, the fire spreads where it can, where it finds oxygen, and the smoke lingers in a way that would confuse astronauts.
And that's just it, Tim. You really wonder how astronauts can react to what is a very different kind of fire, and being confused, well, that's not a good option. I was wondering if a fire on board a spacecraft would sound different. For example, we're used to that crackling sound, which at a campfire is quite fun. But in microgravity and in the unusual atmosphere used on board spacecraft, the sounds of a fire would also be different than that found on the ground. And that's because the sounds of a fire depend on air pressure and the composition of the air. Inside a spacecraft, the air pressure is different, and obviously the composition on board a spacecraft is going to be quite different from what's outside your door. And as we mentioned, fires in space burn cooler than on Earth, which would also diminish the sound of the fire. Well, that's what the science says, but interestingly, there's really only been one actual fire with flames and smoke, and that was on board the Mir spacecraft back in 1997. And that fire was spotted by one cosmonaut before any fire alarms went off. You'll hear about that later on this episode. So let's get into that, Tim.
Okay, we're going to talk about one of the scariest moments you just mentioned, 1997 and the Soviet Union's Mir space station. Now, the station was about the size of a small apartment, but as many as six cosmonauts could be living on board. The fire started when an oxygen-generating canister called a Vika malfunctioned. Now, these canisters were essential for producing breathable oxygen, but they were not without risks. And so we're going to get into a bit more detail about these canisters in a minute or two. But I want you just to think, the canister ignites, starts to burn. It must have felt like forever to the crew. And at the same time, it's releasing a toxic smoke that's going to fill the station. The five cosmonauts and one astronaut had to act fast. They grabbed fire extinguishers and respirators. But here's the kicker, Steve. The fire was blocking their escape route to the Soyuz capsule. That was their lifeboat back to Earth.
Well, talk about high stakes. And yet the crew managed to extinguish the flames, but the smoke lingered for hours, and they had to rely on respirators until that air was cleared.
Not surprisingly, this incident was a huge wake-up call, and it led to better fire safety measures on the International Space Station. And that involved advanced smoke detectors and improved fire extinguishers that were designed for microgravity.
And thankfully, everyone on Mir made it out alive. But it's a reminder of just how dangerous space can be.
That's true on the one hand, but then there's that sloppy workmanship angle that we saw in the Apollo 1 fire. Sometimes people can set aside that duty of caution just to get things done and get them done quickly or cheaply or both. So, Steve, you're the science guy in the show. The problem started with these oxygen generators called Vika. Just what was going on in these things? How did they work? And were they like the Ladas of space gear?
Well, perhaps they were, Tim. And yes, the oxygen generating canister known as Vika had a reputation of being somewhat unreliable and risky even before the Mir space station fire in 1997. Now, these canisters were part of the Soviet-designed life support system and were used to produce oxygen by igniting a chemical compound called solid lithium percolate, which releases oxygen as it burns.
You're already scaring me. Starting with a compound that you, what, set on fire inside a spacecraft. I mean, what could possibly go wrong, Steve?
Well, it actually does come down to that, Tim. The chemical reaction in the Vika canister was highly exothermic, producing intensive heat during its normal production of oxygen. This meant that any malfunction or improper handling could easily lead to a fire. During normal Mir operations, the three resident crew members' oxygen needs were met by two electron oxygen generating units. These units are also now used aboard the International Space Station, and they generate oxygen through the electrolytic splitting of water, primarily reclaimed from sources aboard the station. When the larger crew inhabited Mir, remember there were supposed to be three, now they're up to six, the solid fuel oxygen generators, also known as Vika, supplemented the electrons. The Vikas were utilized for decades aboard Soviet and Russian submarines and for years aboard their space stations. The Vikas burned canisters of solid lithium percolate, as mentioned, that chemically generated oxygen, and each canister provided enough oxygen to support one crew member per day. Although used without incident more than 2,500 times aboard Mir, on this day, the canister burst into flames. And yes, this wasn't the very first time these oxygen generators had been an issue. There had already been reports on minor issues with Vika canisters on earlier missions. Things like the percolate not burning evenly, and in other instances, signs of overheating. And while these problems were typically resolved without major incidents, they did highlight and foreshadow the risks associated with the system.
You know, I remember Alan Shepard joking about all the parts of his Mercury spacecraft being built by the lowest bidder. So was that the issue here, that the Vika was skimping on quality?
Well, perhaps not. Perhaps it was more the lack of alternatives. The Vika canisters, as we mentioned, were widely used because they were compact, efficient, and reliable under normal circumstances. And at the time, they were the popular choice generating oxygen in space, so crews had to carefully monitor their use. Now, in this particular case, it's suspected a torn piece of rubber glove worn by an assembler in a factory somehow contaminated the cylinder.
Got it. Well, we've provided some context here for a bit of a Space Talks classic. Steve, you were able to track down an amazing recording of the incident. So what did you get?
Well, I've got Dr. Jerry Leninger, who was the only American on board, and you'll hear him speaking of the incident. And you will hear some Russian voices in the background, and those are the cosmonauts. And then you'll hear an English speaker over top of that, and that's the Russian translator. So let's have a listen to the fire aboard the 1997 Mir.
Equipage. The crew didn't find out about the fire until the smoke sensors went off.
And then I hear that old master alarm going off, and you hear this loud blang, 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 blang. And I say, well, I better go check and see what's going on out there. So I leave the ceiling, fly into the node, turn the corner to go look at the caution warning panel. But before I can get there, I see Vasily Sablyev come flying around the corner very fast. And I yell out, Seryozhny, and he says, Da, ochen pozhar. I asked, is it serious? He said, yes, very, fire. I looked down the length of the module, sort of a school bus size module right at the end. I see a big flame coming out, you know, 2, 3, 4 feet in length, sparks flying off the end of it. Sort of looks like sparklers on the 4th of July, letting about 100 of them all at once, sparks flying.
Cartridge was like an acetylene torch. A powerful high temperature flame is coming out of that unit.
But when I squint a little harder, I realize it's not balls of wax, it's molten metal. This flame is already melting metal and splattering it. And so, of course, you say, you know, this is the thing you train for. This is a bad event. This is fire. It was an intense, tough blowtorch-like fire. That blowtorch points down. Not only do you have a fire, but now you've got a blowtorch hitting a little aluminum hull about that thick. And that's going to pierce that hull, rapid decompression, quick suffocation. So you've got two of the three worst things that can happen in a space station really very close to happen.
Valery Korzun immediately took control of the whole process. He told us all what to do, and everyone immediately followed all his orders. I prepared the ship for emergency evacuation.
Crew went over, started activating a Soyuz capsule for evacuating. But unfortunately, the one capsule was cut off by the fire, so we could not escape through that. All right, what do I need to do? I need to get an oxygen respirator on. We need to get to that fire extinguisher. And I almost had to tell myself, okay, Jerry, get going. You don't have too much time. It's getting unbreathable in here. So first thing was heading for a respirator. I head for the respirator. I finally locate that respirator, yank it off the wall, full rubber mask over my head, little oxygen canister next to it. I flip the lever over to activate it. You know, I breathe in and I get nothing. Check the lever position again, it's set correctly, breathe in again. Got a failed respirator. I'll yank that off my head. But finally get to that second respirator, yank it off the wall, full rubber mask, activate. I get oxygen, breathe in, and I just hyperventilate, get my blood oxygen level back up, and then I just scream out, we're gonna get that fire out.
Everyone did just the right things. We carried fire extinguishers. The fire was actually put out by Valery Korzun.
It's the second one, exhaust the third one. This is a big, powerful flame, so we're not putting it out.
It was tough because the substance burning releases oxygen. The station filled with steam. Steam so dense you couldn't see anything at arm's length away.
Finally, in the fourth fire extinguisher, are able to get that fire out. Smoke everywhere still. I'm an MD, doctor in me kicks in, and I say, man, we are still in big trouble. Tell my crewmates, go to the end of a distant module, slow your metabolic rate, make everything.
Steve, listening to that description of the event is absolutely frightening. At the end of that recording, you heard Dr. Leninger mention his concern about the well-being of his fellow astronauts. Well, they were extremely fortunate that none required medical attention or special treatment at any rate.
And think about that. The good doctor was describing a flame that was hot enough to melt metal, but fortunately wasn't directed at the thin shell of the space station. Had that been the case, there would have been both an uncontrolled fire on board and a breach of the hull. And of course, that would have left the cosmonauts without air and they would have suffocated.
It's just incredible, you know. And when the proverbial dust settled, the result was quite similar to the period after the fire aboard Apollo 1 that would happen back in 1967. Investigators and analysts at that time, they were led to a conclusion that we need new safety precautions and a lot more. So let's shift our attention to where things have evolved. There have been a few relatively minor incidents on board the ISS and other spacecraft, but I think the story shifts after the Mir fire.
It certainly does, Tim. In the early days of spaceflight, NASA often relied on CO2 extinguishers, which worked by displacing oxygen around the fire, effectively smothering the flames. However, in the closed environment of a spacecraft, releasing large quantities of CO2 itself poses a serious risk to the crew. And why? Well, because breathable oxygen levels drop as the CO2 fills the cabin, and that too could lead to asphyxiation.
You know, another issue with CO2 is the extreme temperature change when it's discharged. In a microgravity environment, that can cause the hardware or surfaces to become brittle under rapid cooling. Later on, that can risk serious safety to those systems. So next up was the use of halon-based systems, which were more efficient at extinguishing fires without leaving residue. But halon 1301 was recognized as an ozone-depleting substance, prompting yet another search for something new and better.
And here enters Halotron, patented and produced by American Pacific. It's a clean agent fire suppressant designed to replace halon. Halotron doesn't deplete the ozone layer and leaves virtually no residue, making it ideal for sensitive electronics. NASA, the International Space Station, and various terrestrial labs have run training sessions with these clean agent extinguishers to ensure astronauts can handle fire emergencies without damaging crucial systems.
In microgravity, every second counts. You need an extinguisher that won't reduce oxygen to dangerously low levels or coat surfaces with corrosive powders. And during astronaut training, crews practice this with simulated fires to learn how these extinguishers behave in zero G, keeping in mind the unique flame spread patterns which occur without gravity.
Well, given all the space travel that's happened since 1997, it seems that fire suppression has been quite successful. And I've read that there are new technologies coming along, like water mist systems adapted for space or aerosol-based extinguishers that could even be more efficient and environmentally friendly. These aim to minimize toxic byproducts, reduce mass and volume, and of course, ensure absolute reliability in a life-supporting dependent environment.
And so, today we hope you've gained some insight into the dangers of fire in spacecraft, and perhaps encourage listeners in this last half hour of Space Talks to conduct some of their own research into this very real and interesting topic. We know that we'll continue to monitor these challenges and developments. And until next time, this is Tim Woods.
And Stephen Lowry saying so long. And we'll see you next time on
Space Talks.
Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along?